I love it when you're teaching and somebody else is teaching before you, and everything that they're saying is like just a connection to what we're going to be talking about. And it's just, it's really cool to see God's spirit at work in his church, that it's not about me. It's not about Pastor Jack. It's God has a message to preach to us today, and he unifies it through his spirit and how he guides his church. And so it's just really cool. Jack was talking a lot today about our desires, and that's what we're going to be talking about here with Augustine. And it's a little washed out with the light here, but this is a fairly typical representation of Augustine. And like we talked about with Jerome and some of this religious art, that there's all these symbols that attach to these guys. Augustine's is the heart on fire. And you'll see that in depictions of Augustine. And in this depiction by Philippe de Champagne, painted around the 1600s, you have the heart on fire representing the affections that are created for God that illumine the mind. And you see he's looking back at what says veritas, which is Latin for truth, right? And so it's the affections of the heart spark the intellect for God's truth. And that's found where he's looking back here at the scriptures. And then another point here is he's got the quill, right? He was a prolific writer. And you see that he's doing his own writings, but his foot is on the writings here of Calestus, Pelagius, and Julian. It's kind of hard to tell, but it's written on the side margins of those pages there, that those were his opponents and contemporaries who he taught against. So this is Augustine of Hippo. And the great thing about Augustine is we know a lot about Augustine. We know more about Augustine than almost any early church father. And that's because Augustine wrote an autobiography called The Confessions. And so we have a lot of his own personal information. So we know he was born in 354. We know that he was born in North Africa. And a little bit, towns over from Hippo in Phagaste, I think it's pronounced. But that's where he grew up. And he was born to a pagan father. And his father died when he was very young. His father died when he was about 16. But his mother was a very devout Christian. And we actually know his mother's name. His mother's name was Monica. And I had admonished the mothers a couple weeks ago. Actually, it was last week. That your influence on your sons is profound. And that is the same case that we see here with Monica and Augustine. And so Monica prayed for him consistently. But Augustine had very interest in God as an early man. So at around age 16, his father died, and he had to go start a profession. He didn't get to really finish his schooling as a lawyer. So he started teaching rhetoric because he had to support his family. And also interesting to note, at around age 17, he had a live-in girlfriend. And we don't know her name. He never mentions her name, but he talks about her a decent amount. And he was with this woman from age 17 to age 29, and she was kind of the lower class, and his mother did not approve of this relationship, one, because she was not a Christian, and two, because she was kind of below their social status. And she said, you need a proper wife, not a live-in girlfriend. And they actually had a son together, and his son's name was Adeodatus. And at 19, he moved with his girlfriend and his son over to Carthage. And Carthage, we've talked about that, major city in the Roman Empire. That's also where Cyprian was from, and a few other notable church leaders. And we had talked about the Donatists briefly a while back, and that schism there, that Constantine tried to patch up, that the Donatists were this rival sect to the Catholic Church that had split off over a controversy. So that was all in the city of Carthage. So he had a very close connection with Carthage. And he was a rhetoric professor. And it was actually at this time that Augustine began to pursue Manichaeism. And Manichaeism was a late Gnostic sect. They were not like the early Gnostics. There was a lot more elements of Christianity that had kind of gotten mixed in. It was a little different. But he was a auditor of this group, the Manichaeists. And the auditor was actually the lowest rank. There was like initiate, and then there was other ranks. He was actually kind of the lowest rank. And fairly early on, when he was living in Carthage, he got to meet one of the most renowned Manichaeists in Carthage. And he kind of left unimpressed. This guy couldn't answer all of his questions. So he kind of followed it, but it was kind of the best thing he had going. But there are some people, and we'll get into this a little bit later, that would say he was deeply embedded in Manichaeism in his early life. And that's not exactly the full situation. He was associated with Manichaeism. He kind of followed it loosely for the first, for most of his 20s, but he eventually got away from that. During this time, his mother Monica was praying for him, and she prayed for him consistently. She actually went to a bishop, and this bishop had actually converted from Manichaeism, and she said, "You need to come speak to my son. You can talk him out of his ways here and lead him to Christ." And he said, no, I can't. I can't just by my efforts and by my explanations lead your son out of this false religion. You need to be praying for him, and you need to pray that God opens his eyes. I can't talk to him. And so she starts crying because he wouldn't go. And he sees her tears, and he famously says, Go. The son of such tears will surely not perish. And so even he recognized that it's the Spirit of the Lord, and through prayer is the means by which God calls people to himself, not through a persuasive argument. And so that's what she did. She kept praying for him. And at 29 in 383, he moved to Rome. And he later got a job. About a year after that, got a job up in Milan as a professor. And two things happened to him when he was up in Milan. The first is that he left Manichaeism for Neoplatonism. He had kind of first encountered Neoplatonism in Milan. And what that did for him was it kind of shifted his fundamental assumptions about the nature of God and the nature of the world. Before, under Manichaeism, in a Gnostic sense, he had understood God to be like a spirit body. And under Neoplatonism, which actually borrowed a lot more of its ideas, one from Plato, but two from Christianity, actually talked about God as pure infinite spirit that was able to be known by the human soul, because the human soul bears God's image. And so that was kind of a halfway point for him to kind of wake up to the deeper truth that he had no knowledge of who God was personally, and he needed to have that. And so that kind of shifted his understanding. He abandoned Manichaeism for Neoplatonism. And then the second thing is he started attending Ambrose of Milan's church. So we talked about Ambrose last week, and about Ambrose, Augustine writes, "And I began to love him, of course, not at the first as a teacher of the truth, for I had entirely despaired of finding that in the church, but as a friendly man." And so he didn't go to Ambrose's church looking for truth, but what he did is he found a really friendly pastor who was willing to talk to him and willing to come alongside him. And I think it was really cool, Jack just talking about, doesn't matter what reason you're coming for church. We're just glad you're here. We want to share the gospel with you. And that's what Ambrose did for Augustine. And then he says, that man of God received me as a father would and welcomed my coming as any good bishop should. And so he developed a good relationship with Ambrose. And Ambrose was able to portray the scriptures to him reasonably and intelligently. He had always had an Old Testament issue. He got hung up on the Old Testament God, and that was part of his Manichaeism, that Gnostic background. And Ambrose helped him understand the scriptures. And he soon became convinced of Christianity in an intellectual sense. But he couldn't submit his heart and his will because he had the attractions of the world. And going back to what I was saying with Jack, that's the issue, right? Jack was talking about, oh, I love SportsCenter so much. Well, for Augustine, it was his own lusts. And Augustine, in his Confessions, famously says, Lord, grant me chastity and grant me continence, but not yet. And so he wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted the intellectual satisfaction of Christianity and God, and he wanted his sin. And it was during this time that he left his girlfriend in 385. She was of a lower class. He was kind of getting older. He was progressing in his career and said, I got to get like a real marriage of somebody that's, you know, a noble heiress, somebody who's more my class. And so there was an arrangement going on. He ended up getting engaged to a very young girl, early teens. It was like one of those things that it was like, hey, like when she's of age, you're going to marry Augustine. And that marriage actually never went through. And it was at this time that he was kind of in this process of converting, and he had this very young fiance, and so he was like, well, I'm going to have concubines on the side because I can't over here. So he really struggled with that, and he said, I want my sin. I want to feed the flesh. I want to feed these lusts. And that was his big hang-up in coming to Christ, that I'm going to have to give this up if I come to Christ. And so his conversion finally came in 386. He, according to him in Confessions, he's meditating in a garden, and he just hears a child's voice, you know, maybe across the hedges. He says it was a mysterious thing. He just heard this child's voice saying, take up and read, take up and read. And he had been in the garden reading some manuscripts and books. He had a copy of the New Testament there. And so he just said, I'm going to pick it up and read it. Maybe because he was contemplating this stuff. He was struggling through this. He knew Ambrose. He knew the scriptures. He was conflicted. So he just said, I'm just going to, you know, do the old page through and see where it lands. I'm just going to read that. And so that's what he did. And he opened up to Romans 13 through 14, and it was the first thing his eyes set on. And it says, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and lust, not in strife and jealousy, but instead clothe yourself in the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for your sinful nature to gratify its desires. And he said, I did not want or need to read any further. Instantly, as I finished the sentence, the light of faith flooded into my heart and all the darkness of doubt vanished. And it's like, that's such a crazy thing. Like, that's the verse. It's not John 3:16. It's not anything. No, that's the verse. But that's what God uses. And so God plants seeds of truth. And he had heard the gospel again and again and again in his life. And that was the one thing that finally he felt, God is speaking to me. I need to put away my lusts. I need to crucify these desires. And God awakened his heart to accept that, and faith came into his heart. And so that's his conversion. And it's just like any of our conversions, right? It's we are blind to the truth of God until God enlightens our hearts, opens our eyes to see the truth. Shortly after, his son, Adeodatus, was converted. And so he was saved. And they were baptized by Ambrose in Milan on Easter Sunday in 387 together, father and son. The next year, they returned back to Africa, and he sold all his land and his possessions, and he ended up starting a monastery school And he began to study. He began to write extensively. And the first thing he did was start to write against the Manichees, which had a holding in his area. And his writings became fairly well known fairly quickly. His son, unfortunately, was sick and died shortly after. And we don't know what happened to his girlfriend. He never mentions her again. So the assumption is that they parted ways. And it's unfortunate. But his son died. And so, so we know most of the stuff through his writings. And so his writings became distributed all throughout Carthage, Hippo, all these areas. And in Hippo, there was a guy named Valerius, and he was the bishop of the church there. And he was an elderly guy, and he was a Greek. He was not very proficient or fluent in Latin. And as the culture was becoming more and more Latinized, he was starting to realize, I need somebody that's proficient in Greek, in Latin, to be able to help me, to be an assistant, and to kind of take over when I'm gone. And so he began to pray about this. And one day, Augustine was visiting his church in Hippo. And like I said, he had gotten some notoriety. And so he's there in the church. People were greeting him. And Valerius just decides that he's going to switch up his sermon this morning. He starts preaching on the need for young men to come and fill in the shoes of the older guys. And the church was just like, we got him right here. And so pretty soon, the entire church was like, hey, let's get Augustine over here, and he can be our bishop. And so what he ends up doing is he ends up staying on, and he stayed with him for 5 years, working under Valerius, being mentored by him, things like that, in transition. And then Valerius died about 5 years later. And Augustine, because he's known as Augustine of Hippo, he's known that way because he spent the next 35 years of his life preaching and teaching out of Hippo. And what we know from him comes from a whole host of writings, but his most famous three writings are the Confessions, which was a little bit earlier. And this is, as I've mentioned a couple times now, it's an autobiographical sketch of his life and personal reflection about the nature of life, the nature of conversion, God, creation, the mind, how God works in the human heart. And so that has been a great encouragement to many believers throughout the years. The second one that is kind of one of his bigger ones, started writing it in 400, finished probably around 417, is on the Trinity. And this explores the Trinity in light of all the other stuff that we've talked about. But what he does is he does teach that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. And we briefly talked about that a couple weeks ago. And Augustine was really instrumental in tying that connection in. And he also explores the unity of the Trinity. And so over in the East, the Eastern Church, the divine nature of God was unified in the person of the Father. That's how they formulated the Trinity. And it's called monarchical Trinitarianism. And this is actually when the church later split East and West, the Greek Orthodox Church, all that, they hold to a formulation of the Trinity known as monarchical Trinitarianism, that the unity of the Trinity is centered around God the Father. Augustine in the West said, no, actually, it's the unity of the Trinity is found in the divine essence that is shared by all three. And so that is a major distinction between Western and Eastern Christianity to this day. His final and largest work that has become a classic is The City of God. And he wrote this in 410, and it's a polemic against pagan accusations against Christianity in the aftermath of the Visigoth sacking of Rome in 410. The Visigoths were a Germanic tribe, came down, and they sacked Rome. That was unheard of in this day. The fact that they could do this and get away with it was like what just happened. Our world collapsed. It was their 9/11 like times 10. And so all the people in Rome were saying, we've abandoned the old gods. We've gone wayward. All this Christian stuff has brought nothing but disaster for us. And so this was a polemic against that kind of thinking. But what he also did was he put together a theological presentation of human history that contrasts the city of man with the city of God. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So we're going to talk about a couple of items as it relates to what Augustine taught. And we're going to kind of go through his ecclesiology fairly quickly. But he was very favorable towards Cyprian. And if you remember when we talked about Cyprian was one of those early Eastern church fathers that really helped move the ball forward in terms of what we would now consider the Catholic Church. He was very big in Catholicism, that the unity of the body of Christ was centered around the church and the authority vested in the church. And he pulled a lot from Cyprian. And he was also involved in the Donatist controversy. And the Donatists were a splinter sect of Christianity that had gone off and said, hey, we're Christians. And it wasn't even so much a doctrinal shift as it was we don't accept all of the corruption and stuff that we see in the Catholic Church. And so they splintered off, and Augustine was very vested in the idea of bringing them back into unity and fellowship with the Catholic Church. And as I had mentioned previously, Constantine had tried to bring them back in by force, by taking away their church lands, their buildings, things like that, by persecuting them. And at first, Augustine was a little bit apprehensive to persecute the Donatists. But what ends up happening is he starts seeing that a little bit of persecution actually brought people back into the Catholic Church, and then they just became good Catholics. And so he said, well, I'm kind of for that. And what we see is that Augustine's ecclesiology promoted the state acting as a father to discipline wayward children. And his idea of the unity of the body of Christ is that it's found in the expression of the Catholic Church. And he does make a distinction between the visible and the invisible institution of the church. And so he would say that the church is unified, but there are wheat and tares that grow up together, right, according to what Jesus said. And he would say that there's the earthly visible institution, and he would call that sacrament. And then he would say that there's the spiritual or the invisible body of the elect. And he called that the mysterium. That's what we don't see, the invisible nature of the church. But he would also say that sacraments are the means of grace, and they're only spiritually effective in and flow through the Catholic Church. And so his view on the church is basically what you see is what you get. You guys are all Christians. And you have some kind of real unique connection to Christ. You have a union to Christ. And whether you persevere in that union to Christ is yet to be seen. That will be determined. That's those who are part of the invisible. But the visible church is actually very much a real union and connection to Christ. This is different than what the Reformers taught. The Reformers made a distinction between the visible and the invisible church. And they would say, yes, there are people that are present in this congregation that may not know Christ. And I'm not going to call them a member of the church or a part of the church, or I'm not going to call them a Christian. They are not part of the church. The church is actually only those who God has elected. Augustine would say, no, you're all Christians and you all have a very real connection to Christ. It's just whether or not that connection is going to persevere. And so it's a distinction. It's a faulty distinction. But just to understand Augustine's ecclesiology, it was very pro-Catholic Church. And he viewed the church in terms of the true mother who nurtures Christians, that the church is there to bring Christians in, to teach them and to mature them. And the Christians are the bride of Christ. And so this idea of mother and bride was both applied to the church, and that was his teaching there. Next, we get to Augustine's eschatology, and this mostly comes from his work, The City of God. And his work, The City of God, was the first systemization of amillennialism. And amillennialism is actually, and currently, the Catholic and the Orthodox Church's viewpoint on eschatology. It's also the position of the Reformers. It's also the dominant position of Protestants until it started waning in the 1700s with the advent of postmillennialism, and then again in the 1800s with the advent of dispensational premillennialism. So this is extra. But what we have here, and I thought it was interesting because a lot of times people, when they start talking about eschatology, everybody gets a little hot under the collar, and they all go back to the early church fathers, and everybody wants to claim everybody. And I'm like, whoa, you all need to slow down, because there's some of these guys that, like, they may hold your position, but like, you might not want to claim that person because of everything that goes with them. So what we see in the early church is two predominant views. We see amillennialism and we see kiliasm. Kiliasm is basically a precursor to what we would call millennialism, the belief that there is a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth after the day of the Lord. And so what you have here, this first one is called post-tribulational premillennialism. You got the tribulation period, you have the second coming, you have a literal 1,000-year millennium, and then last judgment. Pre-tribulational dispensational premillennialism, you have second coming or rapture of the church, a 7-year tribulation, second coming, literal 1,000 years, last judgment. Postmillennialism says that basically the church, through its progress, actually ushers in a millennial golden age, a golden age of the church that lasts 1,000 years, and Christ comes back at the end of that. That's what came in around the 1700s. Lots of optimism in that era, fairly late in the game. And then we have amillennialism, which says the 1,000 years isn't to be taken literally. It's a figurative expression of the age of the church, that this is a time of tribulation that goes from the time of Christ all the way to the second coming, that Christ comes back and settles the score on all things, and then that's the end. And this is just representative of the church age. So this is Augustine's view. This is the view of Jonathan Edwards and some of those guys in the 1700s. This is the view of most of Baptist evangelical churches in America today. And this is what you'll see little smatterings of in early church history. And so this is also called historic premillennialism. And so in early church history, you see this view and you see this view in seed form. None of it is systematized. And so when you see a dispensational premillennialist or even a historic premillennialist say, oh, hey, these guys represented my view, they don't represent the view. When you see an amillennial say, hey, Augustine represents my amillennial view, he doesn't really represent your view. All this stuff has become systematized further so that it's very hard to recognize this stuff. What I've done here is I've put a list of those who lean towards amillennialism and those who lean towards kiliasm, which is the millennial position, and then those who are a little bit ambiguous. And so what you'll see here is you'll see that over here in the amillennial category, you got Clement, and that's not Clement of Rome, that's Clement of Alexandria. You have Origen, you have Cyprian, and Augustine. These guys are the Eastern, right? And so if you're thinking Eastern, you've been tracking with us, you'd say, oh, they go for that allegorical interpretation, right? And so that kind of matches with, okay, the 1,000 years is more of that allegorical interpretation of that. Then you have Papias, who is like one of the earliest guys, really spotty record with him, and also just fragments. Then we have Justin Martyr and we have Tertullian, and both these guys fully expected a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth. And so these guys are fairly early. They're second century. Most of these guys are late second century to third century. Augustine's fourth century. And then you have Irenaeus and Polycarp, who they're also early, but half the stuff they say seems like it could line up here. Half the other stuff they say seems like it could line up here. But what we got to realize is that most of the early church fathers, they were not talking in terms of systems of when Christ is going to come back or anything like that. They were really concerned more with going against the Gnostics in the fact that there would be a physical resurrection, that the body would be physically resurrected. I do like what Justin Martyr says here. He says, I admitted to you formerly that I and many others are of this opinion, that there's a literal 1,000-year view. And I believe that such will take place, as you assuredly are aware. But on the other hand, I signify to you that many who belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians think otherwise. And so Justin said, hey, there's a multiplicity of views out here, whether this is literal 1,000 years or not. And Justin's writing early to mid second century, and he already recognized that there's a couple of views out there, and that these good people, they have different views than I do, and they're still true Christians of the pure and pious faith, and we shouldn't be distinguishing ourselves on hard lines on this issue. And so that's Justin. But more importantly here, we want to get to Augustine's soteriology, and B.B. Warfield is famous for saying that Augustine's, I'll just read the quote. He goes, the Reformation inwardly considered was just the triumph of Augustine's doctrine of grace over Augustine's doctrine of the church. And so the Reformation was Augustine's doctrine of the church being discarded and his doctrines of grace upheld. And to best understand his writings, we need to look at the Pelagian controversy. And the Pelagian controversy, you like this picture I found? Pelagius Hereticus, I like that. But Pelagius was a monk, and he traveled from the British Isles over to Rome in 380. And we talked about Jerome last week, right? Jerome, he's always making friends. One of the reasons we know that Pelagius was from Rome is Jerome was like, yeah, he's the guy that's stuffed with Irish porridge. So, you know, nice guy, Jerome. But Pelagianism was condemned as heresy in 431. And so it's something that it sounds like the nail was put in the coffin. It absolutely was not. And his issue was, he was reading Augustine's Confessions. And in Book 10, Chapter 29, Augustine says, give what thou commandest and command what thou wilt. And what he's saying there is, whatever you command, you have to give me what you command. I can't do it on my own. I need God's grace to do what God commands. And Pelagius had an issue with that. And he says, no. That's not the case. And Pelagius, when he came down, he started basically a holiness movement. And he was teaching that everybody should be an everyday monk, that you can go out and you can live a holy life, and everybody can do it. And so here's his core teachings. His core teachings are that man is born innocent, just like Adam before the fall. Every man is born innocent. He says that original sin is only attributed to Adam, and what we inherited from Adam was simply a bad example, and we all kind of tend to follow in it. He said that sin is a learned behavior, but every man has a completely free will and can choose to do good or evil. Through the exercise of free will, it's possible for man to live a sinless life, always choosing the good. Grace facilitates obedience, but is not required for obedience. In the Pelagian system, grace is seen as God giving his law. That because we have God's law, now we know how to act. And now we need to will ourselves to obey God's law. And we have the example of Christ. And so God was given to us, Christ was given to us as a means of grace so that we have now a good example to look to. And now we need to will and effort our way to follow Christ and not Adam. And his biggest thing here is his contention with Augustine was that whatever God commands implies the ability of the one who receives the command to obey it. And man should not have to ask for grace in order to be obedient. So that was Pelagius. And so Augustine starts writing against Pelagius. And one of the first things we need to understand about Augustine's view is he has what he calls the fourfold state of man. And he has posse peccare, non posse non peccare, posse non peccare, non posse peccare. Okay? Got all that? Able to sin. Man is created able to sin. This is the state of innocence or pre-fall. Then what we have is man fell in Adam. We have man is not able not to sin. He's post-fall. And this is the natural state of man that we all experience. Not able not to sin. Then we have able not to sin. This is a state of grace. This is the regenerate man. This is what you and I experience as new creations in Christ. We have capacity to sin, and we still sin every day, but we actually have the capacity to not sin through faith in Christ, that we actually can start doing good as we follow God through his grace. And then finally, we will get to the eternal glorified state where we are unable to sin. And so, according to Augustine, the human race was affected by Adam's fall. It affected our nature. And I'll go to the next slide there. And we're all born with a fallen nature. And we still have a free will. Because just to put it simply, man still has the ability to choose what he wants, but he lacks the desire for righteousness. He's naturally free, but he's morally enslaved to his own corrupt and wicked desires. So for Augustine, the man is still free to choose. He's a volitional being, but left to himself, man will never choose righteousness precisely because he does not desire righteousness. So Augustine distinguished free will and liberty, and he said that the fallen man has free will, but he's lost his liberty, his moral liberty. He must always choose in accordance with his desire and with his nature. When we sin, our will is free in the sense that we always sin willingly. So the issue that's always brought up here is, isn't this determinism? If I must always do something, then in a sense, my actions are determined. And if my actions are determined, how can I be free? And Augustine recognized this. And the classic answer to this very difficult question is that the determination of my choices comes from within myself. The essence of freedom is actually self-determination. It's when my choices are forced upon me by an external coercion that my freedom is lost. If I'm not being coerced, I'm still free. To be able to choose what I want by my own self-determination actually doesn't destroy free will, it actually establishes free will. So when we choose, we always choose according to our strongest desire or inclination in the moment. And this means that there's a reason for the choices that we make. The actual choice is the effect or the result. The antecedent cause that causes that result is actually our will. It's our choices. It's our disposition and it's our desires. If all effects have causes, then all choices likewise have causes. If the cause is apart from me, then I'm a victim of coercion. If the cause is from within me, then my choices are self-determined and I am free. So if everyone fell in Adam, then no one would be saved, right? If all of our desires, all of our dispositions, our highest need is to fulfill our own pleasures, nobody can turn to Christ. And so earlier in his life, he viewed election as based upon God's foreknowledge, that he looks down the quarters of time and sees who would choose him. And as he thoroughly examined the scriptures and the understanding of the nature of the will, he concluded that God had to choose sinners from his own will and his sovereign gracious purposes in order to be saved from any merit of their own. So it's God who elects salvation through his mercy and his grace. And if he does not elect, then it's not a problem because he's merely acting out of his justice and his righteousness. Some people have accused him of borrowing this idea from Manichaeism. We ran out of time. I didn't have time to talk about it. So if you have questions on that, I'm happy to answer that after the class. But what we got to realize is that what came after this was semi-Pelagianism. And this is kind of a softening. And this is saying, yeah, humanity fell in Adam, and we can't be saved apart from Christ's grace. But just like the sick person who takes himself to the doctor, fallen man can still cry out for help to God, for God's grace. And this is called semi-Pelagianism. And this is actually the predominant error in the church today. And this is rampant. And it's rampant in the Catholic Church. They say they embrace Augustine in this matter, but they don't. And we got to just go to the scriptures here, right? And this is what James says. But each one, when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust, or we could translate that desires, it's when the desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. This is what Augustine found in the scriptures. And then Romans 3, none is righteous, no, not one, none understands, none seeks for God. So Augustine helped us to understand these things. He systematized it. He wrote it all down. And he searched the scriptures. And I hope that you can read, when you have time, the stuff that I printed out for you. Chock full of scripture references. He is a master at pulling those references together and building out his arguments. So we are dismissed. Thank you for staying late. Next week, we're going to talk about Council of Chalcedon. We're going to be talking about the nature of the incarnation. I want to breeze through that so that at the end of class next week, we can take like 15 minutes. And like, if you guys have questions or if there's something you want to share that you're like, hey, I've learned this year. And like, this was something that I never knew before I started studying this stuff. I'd love to hear that. I'd love for you to be able to share that. So I want to kind of take a real quick overview, and then hopefully we can do some more interaction next week. So thank you. You're dismissed.